symbols are powerful. I know they may appear harmless. And I know at times they may even seem insubstantial altogether. But I'm telling you, symbols are powerful. Let's do this. We're going to throw some symbols on the screen. Whenever you see the symbol, as soon as you know it, yell it out. Okay? Go. Oh my. You know what's interesting? Is a couple of things. Number one, I didn't have to say a word and you knew them. Number two, if you noticed, there wasn't a single word on the screen. It was just all symbols. But you knew them intuitively. Why? Well, these companies don't spend millions of dollars developing logos and symbols for no reason. Because, you see, the companies understand. Symbols have power. Symbols are powerful. And it's one of the reasons why people will do things like this. Why do they do that? I mean, why don't they just say, we don't like them over there? Why don't they say, we hate America? Why don't they just say that? Oh, because they understand. Symbols are powerful. Because there's something about symbols that ignites intense emotions. There's something about a symbol that connects you to a narrative that is bigger than yourself. There is something about a symbol that is absolutely powerful. You see, symbols are powerful because they offer you an identity. Symbols are powerful because they offer you an identity. I had no idea that we had failed her until she said this comment. I mean, I didn't even realize we had made a mistake, that we had failed her until she said this comment. I had been preaching at this church as the senior minister for about 2 years. And we came there and we really tried to emphasize the grace of Jesus Christ. We really tried to emphasize being undignified in worship and being able to run to Jesus and embrace Him. And I just didn't realize we had made a mistake. It's not that those aren't true. I just didn't realize we had made a mistake until she said this comment. You see, it came to that point in the service where, you know, the lights went down and the beautiful music was playing underneath and all the communion plates started being passed. And the communion plates came to these two senior saints, these two women who had been the backbone of this church for generations. It came to them, and God love them, you know, that they both were a little bit hard of hearing, so whenever they tried to whisper something in the service, it was like an announcement for everyone to hear. You know, it's like, oh, she didn't like that point in the sermon, you know, she just tried to tell her friend, but everyone heard it. Well, the plates came to her, and they both took the emblems, and then she leaned over to a friend and whispered an announcement. She said, I wish these crackers came with peanut butter. The comment hit me like a dull thud. Because I realized in that moment we had failed her. That we, the leaders of that church, had failed her. Because we hadn't communicated clearly to her that this isn't just a little chiclet in a shot glass that gives you a mid-service snack. That's not what it is. We had failed her. We had failed to teach her that this is not something that we do to try to get sustenance that only a full meal could provide. We had failed to teach her the power of this symbol. For symbols are powerful. They're very powerful. Because they offer us an identity. And I realized in that moment that I didn't really know if I knew the power of that symbol. I mean, I had taken communion ever since the age of 9. I mean, every Sunday, ever since I was baptized, the age of 9, I had taken communion. And yet, I don't know if I really understood what communion meant, what communion did, what it was. And the more I teach and the more I travel, the more I talk to Christians, the more I realize I'm not the only one that doesn't really understand the power of this symbol. Because for most of us, it's a ritual that we engage with, but it is not something that we allow engage us. But you see, symbols have power because they offer us an identity. And I think the reason why that this symbol has lost its power is because we do not connect the symbol to the story. You see, communities are not created with bigger and better buildings. Communities are not created with better light shows. Communities are created when they attach themselves to a story. For story gives you identity. For a story gives you a purpose and mission. Stories unite very diverse people. And we've forgotten to connect the symbol to the story. The story that gives the symbol its power. While our text for this morning is Luke chapter 22, verses 14 through 23, that's not where the story behind this symbol really begins. The story behind the symbol doesn't even begin in Matthew 26. It doesn't even begin in Mark 14. As a matter of fact, the story behind the symbol of the Lord's Supper doesn't even really begin in the New Testament at all. It does begin in a garden. The story does begin in a garden, but it's not Gethsemane. The story begins in the Garden of Eden in Genesis chapter 3. You see, God had just finished creating. He had just finished carving and molding and forming and impressing His image onto His prized creation, man. And then in Genesis chapter 3, tragedy strikes. For His prized creation invited sin into the world. His prized creation invited death and decay, and now they were known for that instead of communion with Him. But God's heart was set on redemption for His rebels. God's heart was set on redemption even whenever He put them outside of Eden. His heart was set on redemption. Even whenever He sends the flood in the time of Noah, His heart was set on redemption for His rebels. And this story really starts to take form whenever we're introduced to one of the central characters, one of the central figures named Abraham. Now, you know, whenever God first talks to him, that wasn't his real name. We're just going to call him Abraham for brevity's sake. God's heart is set on redemption, and He comes and He says, "Abraham, I want to talk with you." And God starts to lay out, and not only does God promise Abraham that He will make him the one that is the father of descendants as numerous as the stars, not only does He promise Abraham to be the bearer of the covenant and the blessing that will bless all of the nations, but He also promises Abraham a land. A land for the people to live in. For the people to multiply in. For the people to experience the riches of the blessings of God. So God comes to Abraham and He says, "Come with me. Come with me, Abraham. Come with me on this journey and I will take you to a land. I will make you experience all the blessings of the covenant. All you have to do is come with me." And so Abraham responded by going with God. He picks up his whole family and they actually adopt a nomadic life. Abraham and his descendants, they are journeying on the path to God's land of promise, when all of a sudden, a drought and a famine occur that was so intense that Abraham's descendants have to take refuge in the country of Egypt. You see, Abraham's grandson was named Jacob, and Jacob had a castaway son named Joseph who had found favor in the eyes of Pharaoh. And whenever this drought and famine came, Pharaoh's honor for Joseph caused him to grab the descendants of Abraham and said, "I will take care of them in this time period." And Abraham's descendants said, "Awesome, because we're tired of being nomads. We finally have a land that we can live in." And so they abandoned the quest for the promised land, and they live in Egypt. And frankly, for a long time, it was really good. I mean, they were multiplying in number. They were prospering. They were being blessed. Until, many years later, Exodus chapter 1, verse 8 tells us that a Pharaoh came to power that did not know Joseph. And he looked at all this group known as the Israelites, these foreigners in his land, and he did not see them as something to protect. He saw them as a threat to his power. Because these people, this big of a number, if they decided to turn on us, our whole empire is in trouble. So he says, I've got to figure out how to get this under control. And what he did is he started to put them in intense labor situations to enslave them. Where the bondage of the yoke of the labor they were causing was causing them to die. It was causing them to be crushed under the oppression of this Pharaoh. And yet the people kept multiplying. And yet the people kept prospering, which kind of ticked the Pharaoh off. He's like, well, I've got to figure out something else to do. So he issues an edict, and the edict is to kill all the male children, all the male babies that are born to the Israelites. And it was about this time that the descendants of Abraham began to cry out for liberation. Began to cry out for God to free them. And through their tears, as they're bearing this anguish, God's heart was set on redemption for his rebels. And so God rises up a leader known as Moses. A series of events leads to Moses eventually coming before this Pharaoh. And with the power of God, he is used with the voice of God to tell the Pharaoh, let my people go. God even gives him the power to do these plagues, to remind Pharaoh, or to at least reveal to Pharaoh what will happen if he does not repent and allow his people to leave. And after nine plagues, the Pharaoh still refused to let his people go. He refused to give them liberation. He refused to let them go on an exodus. And then came the 10th plague. The 10th plague that later came to be known as the Passover. A lot of times, whenever we say the word Passover, the idea that is connected in our minds is this idea of to step over, or to leap over, or to cross over, or to pass over. But many scholars believe that this Hebrew word is connected to a unique Egyptian word, which means to protect by covering his wings over. You see, in Exodus chapter 11, verse 5, it is said that all the firstborns in all of Egypt were to die. So instead of picturing God going from house to house and then hopping or passing over the house of the Israelites, it's better to picture God standing in the doorway of the home of the people that belong to him, standing in the doorway that is covered with blood and protecting his people by covering them in the shadow of his wings. This wasn't just an act of protection. This was an act of liberation. This was an act that would lead to an exodus. This story was so important. This event was so life-altering for the nation of Israel that God said, I'm going to institute two symbols so that you never forget your connection to this story. The first symbol comes in Exodus chapter 12, verse 1, where God says, from now on, the first of the year, the month that begins your year, is the month in which the Exodus happens. Why? Because this event defines you. This is who you are. This is who I am. So every single year, whenever they're celebrating the relaunching of all of time, of life, they realize the moment when they were actually created. The moment of their exodus. The moment of their liberation, where God said, I am the liberator and you are my people. And every year, every time they look at their calendar, the symbol of that story hits them square in the face. But God did one other thing. He said, I also want to institute a meal. And every single year, you are to have this meal. This meal that we call the Passover, that modern day people call the Seder dinner. This meal that is saturated in symbols that connects the people to the story. Throughout the years, many different elements came into this meal, and many different elements were cast out of the meal. But what I've done today is I've kind of gathered the key elements and the key progression of the meal so that we can walk through the symbol together. But what I want you to notice is how each of these symbols connects us to a story. The meal would begin by the host coming to the table. Now, this really wouldn't have been the type of table they would have had at the time of Jesus. Leonardo da Vinci, it wasn't like that. They would have been reclining at a table, but this is good enough for now. They would come to the table, and the host of the meal would begin the meal by pronouncing a blessing. He would come and he would say, "Blessed are you, O Lord, our God, the one who has created the fruit of the vine. Blessed are you, O Lord, our God, who has sustained us and enabled us to even come to this season." And then what he would do is he would take the wine and he would pour the first cup. Now, the wine was always red. As a matter of fact, usually the wine was even mixed with warm water. And the idea was, whether you are looking at the wine or whether you are tasting the wine, it was supposed to remind you of the blood of the Lamb that brings redemption. At this meal, at the Passover meal, the wine was always red. And there were actually four pourings, four cups, that all of this meal traces us through. And every cup has a meaning, has a symbolic referent point. The first cup is significant because it launches the entire meal, the meal that defines them as a people. And after they would drink the first cup, then the host would introduce the second element. The second element was bitter herbs. Bitter herbs. And what he would do is he would actually take the bitter herb and he would dip it in vinegar or salt water. And he would invite everybody at the table to eat the bitter herb. And the reason why is because the bitter herb symbolized the oppression and the slavery that all of these people went through in the time of Egypt. An oppression that led them to the point where they were crying out to God to free them, to liberate them. And that's why the salt water is so important, because it symbolizes their tears. See, this isn't just a meal where you're remembering things. It's a meal where you're actually ingesting the story into you, where you are taking part in the story by eating the story, where you find yourself not only relating to the people, but feeling like that you are one of them. After the bitter herbs are introduced, what the host would do then is he would come to the second cup, and he would pour the second cup for everybody at the table, and then he would just let it sit. Just let it sit. And people are thinking, well, that's awful odd. Why is it that we're sitting there? Well, what that did is it prompted the youngest male child to ask a series of four questions. A series of four questions that this young child was to ask every single Passover. And I want you to catch the theme of all four questions. The first question that the child would ask is, why is this night different from all other nights? I mean, on all other nights, we can eat bread or matzah, but why tonight only matzah? The second question, on all other nights, notice the theme. On all other nights, we can eat any kind of herbs. Why tonight, bitter herbs only? The third question, on all other nights, we don't dip herbs into any, we eat into anything. Why tonight do we dip twice? And then the fourth question, on all other nights, notice the theme. We eat meat roasted, stewed, or boiled, but why tonight only roasted meat? You see, the purpose of this questioning was to bring front and center that something was happening in this moment that made this night and this meal different than every other night and every other meal. What is it about this meal that is different? The next thing that would happen is actually the host would introduce the element known as the matzah bread or the unleavened bread. It is unleavened at this meal. There was not. Well, let me explain to you what leaven is. Otherwise, the symbol may not make much sense. Hey-o. Leaven is something that they would add to the dough. And it didn't matter how big the dough was. If you even added just a little bit of leaven in it, the leaven would permeate all the dough like a cancer or an epidemic. It cannot be contained. And then once you took the leaven dough and you cooked it, the leaven causes the dough to rise up, to puff up, to, in appearance, seem like it is more volume. But in reality, it doesn't weigh any more at all. And leaven came to be known as a symbol for sin. That sin, like leaven, when it is introduced to the camp, it spreads like an epidemic. And the sin of pride, like leaven, causes people to be puffed up, to appear as if they are bigger than what they really are. And at this meal, whenever the unleavened bread was taken, it was a symbol that communicated what God had done to his people in the Exodus. He had purified them of their sin. He had redeemed them. And it's at this point in the meal where Jesus starts to shift the tradition. You see, normally what would happen is that the host would take the unleavened bread and he would pronounce two blessings over it. He would say, "Thank you, God, for bringing this bread from the ground. And thank you, God, for teaching us or commanding us to eat this bread." But that's not what Jesus says. In Luke chapter 22, verse 19, Jesus says this: "This is my body. This is my body given for you. Do this in remembrance of me." We hear that phrase so often, it really doesn't strike us at all that unique. It's kind of like, oh yeah, I mean, every communion meditation I've ever heard said that phrase. Do this, remember to me. This is my body. But for the disciples, they knew something different was shifting in this moment. He was changing the tradition because he was not just connecting them to a story. He was actually writing himself into the story. Actually, what Jesus was doing is rearranging the symbols so that they center on him. A bit of a shift. The next thing that the host would do is actually they would come to the climactic moment of the meal. The moment whenever the roasted, unblemished lamb would be eaten. The symbol of God's judgment and wrath being taken away from a people and being transferred to a sacrifice. And one of the things I find very interesting about this particular moment in the meal is because this is the highest point of all the symbolism, and yet not a single gospel records Jesus and the disciples eating the unblemished lamb. Not one of them. Now, I'm not saying they didn't, but what I'm saying is the disciples skip from the highest element or the highest symbol straight to the third cup. The third cup, according to the Jewish Talmud, is referred to as the cup of redemption. This is the cup that when it was poured, they believed that they were actually engaging with the actual blood of the lamb that they had just eaten and was now poured out for their redemption. And when Jesus comes to this element, once again, he shifts the tradition. For in Luke chapter 22, verse 20, Jesus at the third cup says, "This cup is the new covenant. This cup is the new covenant in my blood, which is poured out for you." And at this moment in the meal, there must have been absolute silence. Because what Jesus just said there was so incredibly powerful, the disciples probably didn't know how to process it. The new covenant from your blood? See, at this moment, the disciples would not have been thinking about the fourth cup. The fourth cup, which is about the future redemption that is to come, that is not yet here. They wouldn't have been thinking about the fourth cup. They wouldn't even have been thinking about the end of the table, the empty seat that was reserved for Elijah. Because when Elijah comes back, that means the kingdom's coming with them. They weren't thinking about anything in the future. They were thinking about the redemption in Jesus that was there in the present. Silence would have filled the room. Silence at the thought of a new covenant. Silence at the thought of a new Passover lamb. Silence at the thought of a new Exodus. Where in this Exodus, Jesus' body is broken, his blood is poured out, and we are protected in the shadow of his wings. Silence. Until Jesus breaks the silence with this phrase, "Come with me. Disciples, come with me." You see, symbols have power. Symbols are incredibly powerful because they offer us, they invite us, they can give us a new identity because they are connected to a story. You see, whenever we take the Lord's Supper and we don't have it connected to the story that stretches from the garden in Genesis all the way to the garden in Matthew, whenever we disconnect it from the story, it becomes about as important as a mid-service snack. It leaves you left craving. It leaves you wanting more. Maybe even a little peanut butter just to spice things up. But when we begin to realize that this meal defines us as a people, that this meal infuses all of meaning, all of history with meaning, that this meal connects us to Jesus in a way that no other symbol can, when we begin to understand that this symbol is the ethic by which we live, all of a sudden it starts to shift from a symbol that the world offers us into something we've never seen before. For the symbol doesn't just label us, it doesn't just brand us. The mystery of the Lord's Supper is that when you ingest this symbol invites you to become the symbol itself. You see, when Jesus says, "Do this in remembrance of me," he's not inviting you to think about a story. He's inviting you to become the story. For Jesus looks at us and he says, "Come with me. Come with me into my story of liberation. Come with me into my new Exodus where there is freedom from the bondage of sin. Come with me to the table. And when you come to the table, I will take you and I will give thanks for you. And then I will break you and I will pour you out. And through you, body of Christ, the world will feast on me." Jesus says, "Come with me." In other words, the Lord's Supper is not something that you do. The Lord's Supper is something that is done to you. And so, I just say what Jesus said, and that is, come.